my mum got pregnant with me at 15, had me at 16. So I understand that reason for giving up a child. I met my dad when I was 19 and I didn't like him. He was racist. She came in, got into bed with me and went to sleep. And I woke up and my mum was dead. And you did teach me a lot of very valuable life lessons and also how to be loved and to show love. Welcome to Emily Abraham Presents the Love Luxury Podcast. And today I have with me a very, very, very special guest, and that is my mum, Elaine. So welcome to the show and thank you for coming all the way down from Nottingham to see us.
Thank you for asking me and for inviting me, and I've had a lovely time meeting up with you.
Yeah, it's been so nice to see each other because obviously you're in Nottingham, I'm in London, I'm super busy, you're doing your thing. So we don't really get to see each other very much.
No, we don't. No.
But I really wanted you to come down because it's for more than the purpose of talking about me, actually. I actually wanted to talk about how it was for you taking me on. So that was quite important. But not only that, how it was for you being a foster mum for all of those babies that you fostered. So I'm just going to talk to the guys. So my mum is my foster mum. So this is not my tummy mummy, as we put it. This is my bonus mum. So Elaine took me in when I was 6 years old. And prior to taking me in, Elaine had looked after many, many, how many?
Oh, about 20.
20 little babies, small babies from newborn to toddlers, wasn't it?
A lot were newborn to 8 weeks, pre-adoption.
Yeah.
We would take them from hospital.
Yeah.
And love them and get them to attach so they knew how to attach and prepare the new parents to come and take them away. It was a privilege.
Yeah. So that's my early memories of being with you, are predominantly having babies in the house or small toddlers.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I wanted to talk to you about, not just in relation to me, but to that. So you have three children of your own.
That's right. We call them our homegrowns.
Yep. And that's, we won't go into names and stuff like that. But so you have three of your own children, and then you and Dad were in Bristol. Mm. And is that when the fostering started?
It was. We moved to Bristol and felt really called to open our home up. Yes. Mm. So we went through the process of being vetted and approved. And ours had reached the age where they could manage a sibling, another child coming in and not displacing their places in the family. We felt that was very important. Mm. So that's why we did newborn babies, because it didn't take away John's position at 10 of being the baby of the family.
Yeah.
We were doing short term.
Yeah.
You know, we would do 6 to 8 weeks and then settle them into their new homes. So it worked really well for our family.
But that age group that you took on is probably, what was it that made you decide to go down the route? Because it's not easy to become a foster parent. So like you said, you had to go through all the vetting. What made you and Dad sit down and say, actually, yeah, we're going to go through this rigorous vetting and go down that route?
We were away on a camp. You know, we used to go on church camps. And I felt very clearly through a verse from the Bible, God said to me, strengthen your tent poles and widen your tents. And the more I worked with it, the more it felt like, well, we can do that by offering a safe place to other children, which is what we did. Mm. And our plan was to have babies.
Yeah.
And that's until you came along.
Sticking with the babies, how did it take its toll on you? Because Dad's a civil engineer, and you at the time, I believe, when I came to you, were working in a hospice.
I started in the hospice, yes, as you came. Mm. Before that, I was doing agency type nursing.
Yes.
Because I was just settling into Bristol life, because we hadn't been there very long. Mm. Yeah.
How long had you been in Bristol for?
Well, we started the process not long after we'd been there. So we'd probably been in Bristol 2 years when we started.
Okay. So how was juggling nursing, which is shift work, dad being out doing his stuff that he was doing, so building roads and buildings, and having these newborn babies come in, because it's really strenuous.
It was strenuous, and for a time, because the thing with a newborn baby is you have 8 weeks of not sleeping.
Yes.
Because they're up all night. Mm. So for the times we had a baby, that's why I was agency.
Okay.
I would come off the books and concentrate on trying to find sleep when I could with newborn babies.
Mm.
And then I would go back in between babies. We usually took a month's rest before we had another one.
Mm. You did it properly. So when I say that, you used to use terry nappies.
Absolutely.
So you weren't using disposables. Mm. You were using I remember you washing all those nappies, and you always would sterilize all the bottles by hand, and I remember all of that. So not only were you being a replacement mum for those babies and someone to offer them love and warmth and, like you said, attachment, you were doing all of the really manual stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you had your own children to look after.
Yeah, and renovating the house we lived in.
Yeah, to go up into the loft. Yeah. How was that?
Well, if I look back, I thought maybe I thought at that age I had endless energy. I loved having the babies. And it somehow put a routine back into my life, because I moved to Bristol and I didn't really know very many people.
Mm.
Everyone was at school all day. So I could do some decorating and painting. But then what did I do with my day? So having the babies, I loved the routine. I had to do this in a time and that in time, then get up to school.
Mm.
So I don't think I thought a great deal about it all. That's just what I did.
Okay, that's interesting. So you just kind of fell back into routine of motherhood.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long had you been fostering babies for before I came along?
I think 18 months. So at one point we were having a baby they'd go at 7 weeks, and by the 8th week we had another one. Wow. So we had quite a turnover of babies. Mm.
That in itself is quite shocking to me.
Yeah.
That so many newborn babies needed homes before they were given their forever homes.
Yeah. Of course, we had some babies that didn't go to adoption, and social services used to say to me, "What are you doing?" Because if I had a chance to meet the mum that was handing her baby over, I would try to chat to them and reassure them that we would look after them properly and give them love. And there were some mums who I felt needed to make sure this was the right decision for them. And I would invite them to come to our home and see their baby at home. Because in the hospital, they were in a hospital gown, in a glassing cot. You could detach yourself. I wanted them to see the baby dressed. And I always bought nice clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And see then if this was the right decision. Because sometimes I had an inkling that they were doing this for the wrong reasons.
Mm.
And I had one mum say, "He deserves a better mum than I could ever be." And that I thought, you think like that, you are a good mum already.
Yeah, exactly.
So we used to encourage them to come. And we had 3 babies go back to mum in 1 year.
Which is amazing.
Wonderful. Mm. And one of them, we called him Bilbo Baggins.
I remember that name.
Remember Bilbo Baggins? And mum was an activist. She was fighting against the system she wanted to change and didn't think she could inflict that lifestyle on her baby. So breastfed him for 4 weeks and then came to visit him twice and then phoned me and said, "I've made the decision, I want to have him back." And so she did. And I was at the Sefton Park Junior School. Yeah. I was helping at a fair there. And this lady came up to me and she said, "I know you. Tell me more." I didn't know who she, I didn't recognise her instantly. And she said, "If I say Bilbo Baggins," and it was his mum.
Oh, wow.
And she said, you know, she told me what his name was, and she said, and we've done really well. And then she went, she said, he doesn't know this part of his story yet. But she went and fetched him. And it was so right that she stood by her guns and had him back. And I think sometimes trying to give a baby up when you're emotionally and hormonally in a difficult change is a big decision to make.
I'll talk about time frames here because it puts it into perspective for people. So we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s. That's around the time frame.
Yeah, it's 80s, 82 onwards.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that's right, because I came to you in 84. Why do you think that people give their babies up for adoption?
I think sometimes pressure. Mm. I had an Irish mum that had fled from Ireland pregnant because she wasn't allowed to be in Ireland and pregnant. Her parents were Catholic. And she came to have the baby here so that nobody knew in her village. And then she had to go home without the baby. That was the condition. And I did a lot. We did a lot of work with her and supporting her. And then he stayed with me for quite a lot. He was one of the ones that stayed till he was nearly 10 months old.
Oh, wow.
Because Mum couldn't sign the paper. And in that time, she was seeing him. And he went to a new home. He was turned down by one family, which I was furious about. How can you turn a baby down?
Yeah.
You know, when you have a baby, you don't choose. Yeah. And then another family came and they had him for about 4 months. And tragically for them, Mum decided at court she wanted him back.
Okay.
So he was about 17 months when she'd made a home in England and took him. So that's one pressure that's on women, not, you know, if they haven't got financial support. I had a baby where Mum was very young and it was the absolute right decision that she was 15 and she wasn't mature enough to be a mum at that age.
And I think from there, sorry to cut you off, I think from there we can kind of go on to my mum, can't we?
Yeah.
We can. I'll just briefly say, so my mum got pregnant with me at 15, had me at 16, and it was clearly she was way too young and immature to be able to handle the responsibility of motherhood. So I understand that reason for giving up a child. And I do sometimes wonder if my life had been different if the decision had been made at my birth rather than later on down the road. What other reasons do you think that people, women, girls, would have to give their babies away at such a young age?
It's complicated, isn't it? There's a lot of reasons in the middle of maybe not in a stable relationship and people feeling like Bilbo's mum, that be able to offer the right environment for their baby. Had mums who didn't believe in abortion but knew they couldn't bring their baby up and knew that adoption, because they'd been adopted, was a good option. I think there's multi-layers of why people don't. I think it's there's many less babies now for adoption than there ever were. I think society's changed. I think societal pressure to not have a baby before you're married, or I never had a baby come from a married woman. That was my experience. So yeah, I think there's less society pressure now and stigma around. In the 80s there was still a lot of stigma around being a single mum.
I would agree with that. I think with all of the reasons that you've said, so financially, relationship, maturity, support, pressure, family pressure, you know, religious reasons, many, many different reasons why. I don't think there's a cut and dried answer as to why anyone would give up their baby.
And it's an enormous decision. And I always respected people while they were, when they were making that decision.
You didn't just take babies though, because before we get on to me, I remember a little chap who we had for a little while, and I think not so many years ago you were invited to his wedding.
I'd forgotten him.
He was an absolute cherub, wasn't he? He was such a gorgeous little boy, and he came to you as a toddler.
He was just before his second birthday.
Yes.
Yeah, he was in the children's home here in London. She was on a program to come off drugs.
Mm.
And he was in the children's home because Dad wasn't capable either of caring for him. And she'd done really well. And we were asked to take him, even though we were in Bristol, because she was coming to a safe house there to continue her recovery program. Mm. And she was able to come and see him every day. Do you remember? And we did some parenting with her, and she bonded with him, and he was with us for a year, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was. It was a little horror when he came, actually. He'd been traumatised by being in a children's home, and I sat in that children's home, and I could have taken all six boys in their home with me.
Mm.
They were just desperate to have one-to-one, and so we brought Nicky home.
Yeah, he was such a cute little thing. I have a lot of fond memories of him. And again, staying with the babies. So Josh is my little brother, and he's not so little anymore. He's all 6 foot, how many
about
tall?
About 6 foot three, six foot four.
So he's a tall chap. And he's a fully grown married man living his life. But when I met Josh, he was a very tiny little thing who, from my recollection, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, had been born very prematurely, mm-hmm. had spent the first 3 months of his life in the hospital, and then came to us. And he was literally the size of a newborn baby, but he was 3 months old.
Yeah.
And he was tiny, a tiny newborn baby. And I remember very, very vividly, like you said, you would welcome the parents into the home. His mum was not mentally capable of coming, whatever her reason, her situation was, but his dad did come to the house. And I remember that we had, the door was there, the sofa was there, and the window was there. And I was sat on the floor, and I remember him coming with his little boy and being very emotional about the decision that he was making and saying that he knew that he didn't have the capabilities of taking care of his son, and that he knew that if he had to go out to work, the baby would be left with the mother and she was completely incapable of looking after a child and harm might come to him. So he was making the decision to give Josh up to us as a foster family until a home was found for him. And Josh was the absolute light of our lives.
Mm.
He was the most gorgeous blonde baby with the chubby little cheeks and squidgy rolls. And he used to crawl on the table in his one baby grow with a peg on his bum, on the bum of the onesie. And he really was just a beautiful, beautiful baby. He was gorgeous, wasn't he?
He was.
Beautiful blue eyes, and blonde hair.
Curly hair, yeah.
Oh, he was gorgeous. He brought so much joy to us as a family. But also, what ended up happening is he ended up staying. But that was after I ended up staying. And then Hannah came as well. And what's the age difference between Josh and Hannah?
It was about 2 years.
Yeah, so I thought it was about 2 years. And then Josh got to about two, and then Hannah came along, and it was from the same parents. She was from the same parents. So I was talking, when I said it, I was thinking about the situation was from the same parents. But she was very much like Josh. So she again was born prematurely, again spent a lot of time in hospital, again came to us when she was very small. Am I right?
She came a bit older, she was fatter than...
Yeah. Yeah, she was bigger.
She was bigger, but she wasn't as small as Josh born. But she was still quite underdeveloped for her age, yeah.
But she was the opposite to Josh. So although she was super, super cute, as equally as cute as Josh, she had really dark hair, didn't she? And what colour are Hannah's eyes?
Brown.
They're brown. So they were like Snow White and Rose Red in the book I used to read. Mm. So Josh, you know, the completely different but super, super cute babies. And the same situation happened with Hannah, that she ended up staying. I remember you telling me afterwards that there was a situation with dinner, with you asking me what I wanted to eat.
And you came in and it was late. We'd waited up for you to come. And, you know, what would you like to eat? And your answer was chicken and chips, as it always was.
Still the same now.
we had Spag Bowl all sitting waiting. Yes. Then you began to get a bit nervous. So Jo, the oldest, she wasn't, but you were going to share her bedroom, said, come on, I'll show you around, and took you off to show you the bedroom, and you sauntered off. Dad remembers it so well. You had a coat on that was nearly to your ankles, tied with a piece of string, which you were very fond of, that piece of string. You wore it for quite a few days after. And you had a look around, and you came down, and you said, yeah, this'll do, you said. And then I said, we haven't got chicken and chips, but we're going to have spaghetti bolognese. And it was when we stopped, I got that bit out of order. It was the spaghetti bolognese that made you wobble a bit.
Okay.
And Joe took you off to distract you and brought you back. And, yeah, you very stoically said you'd eat it. And I don't think you minded it. No. I think it was just something new in... But yes, chicken and chips was always your preferred choice.
And I got it the next day, didn't I?
Yes.
Yeah, I did, from that special chicken shop that had the rotisserie chickens in the window on Gloucester Road. Yeah, I remember that. But the reason I came to you was because nobody picked me up from school.
Absolutely.
But that was quite a regular occurrence. So it wasn't the first time that I'd not been picked up from school. And I did have family, extended family. I had a nan and a granddad and aunties and uncles and so an uncle and my mum. I didn't have a dad around, so I never had a dad growing up. From birth, I didn't have a dad growing up, just me and my mum and then the extended family. But what would quite often happen would be that my mum would be the designated collector and she wouldn't come and get me. And the reason for that was because of the lifestyle that she was leading. And unfortunately for her and for me, her life decisions meant that she was incapable, basically, of being a parent. So at the point that I came to you, I'd been forgotten about probably at least 10 or 15 times before. And it was not the first time. So it happened many times before. And I'd been placed in overnight emergency care many times. You weren't the first family that I'd ever come to. And I had some not very nice experiences with some of those families. And I had been to some families maybe for a week or maybe a little bit longer. And some of them, it just was overnight. It was always until they could find my mum. Because back then in 1982, the primary focus was to reunite a child with its parents. Mm. It's very different now. And I think my life might have been very different had the rules and regulations that we have in place now had been put in place then. But the primary focus was to always get me back to my mum. That was their focus. Mm-hmm. They wanted to reunite me with my mum. And I think their hopes were that she would do better, but it never happened. I had a lot of evenings sat in the school on a chair outside the reception, waiting for someone to come and collect me, while the receptionist would nervously ring my nan, my granddad, my aunties, my uncle, try and get hold of my mum. Whoever had a house phone, because at that point in time, we only had house phones. And if people were out because they had their own lives to lead, they wouldn't be assuming they'd need to wait in for a call from my school to see if they needed to come and collect me. So there would be times when Nan wouldn't be in or Granddad wouldn't be in, and those were the times. So it happened a lot of times, but the times that I went into temporary foster care were quite a few up until the point I came to you. So although it wasn't a very nice experience for me, it was something that I'd experienced quite a lot, kind of the norm. And I think that nervousness was probably, I mean, in hindsight, I don't remember, but it was probably, are these people the nice people or are these people the not nice people? Because there was a mix of that in foster care at the time. You couldn't guarantee that everybody was in it for the right reasons. So you said I came and I said, this'll do. And then I ate some spaghetti bolognese. And I didn't go to school the next day, did I?
Well, yeah, you did.
I did.
I washed all your clothes and polished your boots, and you had these little burgundy ankle boots. Yeah. And we did take you to school the next day. We felt that was really important.
Okay.
We took you in a little bit late because you were tired. And then I visited a friend of yours in school's mum. Do you remember Ruth?
Yes. Ruth Morgan?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, and I said, help, we don't have any clothes for a six-year-old and we have a six-year-old. Can we borrow some just to, you know, to keep a school uniform that I was looking for or something for school until I could get out? And I felt it was really important. I was on time at school and we got something just to keep you going for a couple of days until they... Well, we assumed you'd be gone over the weekend, but we just needed something for you.
Yeah. So as it transpired, the reason my mum didn't come and get me from school is because she died.
Yeah, she died. They found her on the Sunday.
But what actually, I don't know if you know, is that she actually died in the same bed as me and that my granddad took me to school knowing that she'd passed away.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I found... So, oh, so I always had this thing in my brain that I was imagining this story of my mum being in the bed, dead next to me. And I actually remember what happened before she died as well. But I remember her coming in, getting into bed, and we were at my granddad's friend's house in St. Paul's, Kojak. I can't remember his real name. So Kojak was with Barbara, and they were in a relationship, but she was my mum's friend. And so we were staying in their flat in St. Paul's with them. And she came in, got into bed with me and went to sleep. And I woke up and my mum was dead. And so I went into the front room and my granddad happened to be in there with Kojak and Barbara. And so my granddad, and I said, mummy's not breathing. And so my granddad basically went into, I don't know what mode, and took me to school. I think he panicked.
That's shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he panicked. I think he didn't know. Yeah,
shocking for him and shocking for you.
Yeah, I mean, because of her lifestyle, he probably partially expected it. But you don't want it to happen. You don't will it to happen. But she did. She passed, and so I went in. And so I remember this happening. But I always thought that maybe I'd augmented my memory. And then I was talking to my auntie in America and I said to her, I've always had this recollection that she died next to me and that I told Grandad. And she said, you did. She said, you told him and he panicked so much that he took you to school because he knew that he couldn't look after you and that if he took you to school, social services would find you somewhere to stay. So he knew and made sure that he wasn't at home because that day... that they brought me to you, they took me to his house first.
I remember that.
And they sat, we sat outside in the car, outside his neighbour's, because there was a car outside his house, and then we sat in the car outside the neighbour's house. And she came out, and she was like, oh, who are you looking for? And they said who they were looking for. And she said, well, he's not in at the moment. Do you want to come in for a cup of tea and wait? So we waited in her living room, which looked out onto the street. And I remember my granddad pulling up, and or walking down the street, which was unusual for him because he would always pull up. So he was walking down the street and he walked very quickly into his house and didn't turn the lights on or anything. And I think that he probably knew that the social services would have been going around because we went to my nan's and she wasn't there.
Yes,
we went
I
to my granddad's
that, yeah.
and he wasn't there. And so they did the rounds with me. And then the phone, I remember the social worker being in the car and saying to herself or to me, I don't know, maybe it was to the woman in the house, can I use your phone because I actually don't know what to do now, I've got nowhere to take her. And then that's where you guys came in, and so that's when I came to you.
Yeah.
But that coat, was it blue?
Yes.
So I've actually got a picture of me in that coat with Alex, because my uncle Alex is 18 months younger than me, so my granddad's son. And I've got a picture of us stood outside his house with me with that blue coat on. And I think he's got like a short red puffer version of it on. But it was like a blue puffer coat, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes. Yeah.
With a string. What colour was the string? Maroon?
Yeah, I can't remember the colour, but you were very fond of that piece of string. You kept it round your middle every day.
It was my little safety thing,
wasn't it, I think. Yeah, the bit of home you were connecting with.
Yeah. So I came to you and it was only supposed to be for a night and I kind of knew she'd gone. So I knew it wasn't, but I'd already learned by that point in my life that we didn't really talk about things. So I remember the social worker coming in at the back. So we had the front living room that I've already described, and then we had the back dining area, didn't we, which was where
the kitchen
was. And I remember us, her walking in and you sitting on the floor with me on your lap. Was it me or you, Joe? No, it was you. It was you.
It was me and Joe.
You and Joe.
Because Joe scooped you up and took you away afterwards to give you some space, because he didn't tell you very well.
He wasn't very good at communication, was he? No. Bless his cotton socks.
And we were horrified to hear him say, "Now you've got to be brave." No. Because I'd known the afternoon before what he was coming to tell you.
Yeah.
He phoned me on the Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. How hard was that for you to know that information and to be able to have to hold it in until he came?
Really hard, actually, because I'd been off to the library that morning to read up on loss with children and loss to see which was the best way to handle it for you. And then he just came in from work saying, "Does she know? Does she know? No, not yet." How he wanted to handle it. And then he just came and said, "Be brave, you mustn't cry." What? because I don't think he knew how to handle it. How do you tell a six-year-old that they're never going to see their mummy again?
Yeah, I mean, you just don't imagine. You just would never want to have that conversation,
would you? And you can't even be truly empathic because you've not been in that situation yourself. You can only imagine what that news must be like.
I don't really have memories or feelings or remember how I felt or anything like that. So I can't say, because it's like my brain has blocked all of that out. But I know that had I not have been with you guys, it would have been a very different story for me. And I am eternally grateful to you and Dad and Joe and John and Sam, because everything happens for a reason. And you weren't supposed to take me in, but you took me in.
Yeah.
And that happened for a reason. And I think that the fact that I didn't go to my fat blood family also happened for a reason, because, and I'll elaborate on that, because my nan already was drinking to numb the pain of what my mum was putting her through, which was regular burglaries of her house and going missing. And, you know, she'd be allowed to see me and then she wouldn't be allowed to see me. So my mum was using me as a tool in her manipulation, which is what most addicts would do. Or it's not right, but I think there's a pattern of behaviour.
There is a pattern.
Yeah. And I think my nan was at a point where she was not coping. And although no parent wants to admit it, she had a favourite, and that was my mum. And my mum was basically doing everything that a parent wouldn't want their child to do.
Destroying
herself. And destroying herself, destroying me, and destroying her own mother and her own family. So at the point of my mum's death, my nan wasn't even allowed to see me at that, you know, by that point. So I don't even know how long it had been since my nan had seen me. The news of losing my mum then meant that the drinking cycle that she was in became far worse. And it not being a drinking cycle, it then became addiction for her. So she was numbing the pain of the loss of her daughter, which was the eldest from my granddad. And she was not coping very well with life, because her daughter had died. And I think it's rational, it's normal.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I would be I don't know how I would cope if anything, happened to one of my own. So for my nan to have gone through all of that she went through with my mum and her relationships and the things that were going on in her own life, and then for her daughter to pass away or to die, was very hard on her. And I don't think, although she was strong in a lot of ways, my nan was not strong in a lot of ways as well. And I think that for her was the beginning of the end. But that beginning of the end took at least 35 years, which is really sad. Yeah, I was six, so about 29, 30 years. So she lived in with that pain for a very, very long time. And this relationship and situation she was in meant that her drinking was so bad that had I have been with her, my life would have been horrendous, and I'd have gone into another addictive home. and seeing things that I didn't need to see, because I was already seeing things with her that I didn't need to be seeing, because she was in a very abusive relationship where they would drink and beat each other up and she'd have black eyes and there'd be a lot of screaming and stuff like that. So I'd already witnessed all that with my nan. So I think that was never going to work. My granddad never felt like a safe place for me. I don't know why, but it just never really felt like a safe place for me. And then all of my aunties, there were reasons, rightly so, why they didn't get custody. Yeah. So one of my aunties had too many children already. She had four of her own. Another one of my aunties had her own son that she was having parental problems with. One of them was way too young. And then the other one was married and lived in the States. And they didn't want to displace me and put me in a completely new environment. So there were many reasons as to why me staying with you was the right thing to do. But it wasn't what you were expecting. When my mum passed, how did you come to the decision that it was okay for me to stay with you for that period, for as long as, which 7 years it was in the end, 7.5 years?
Longer, nearly nine.
Was it? Mm. Okay.
You were 15 and you came at 6. You were 15, you were just in the middle of doing first year of your GCSEs.
So, it's funny, isn't it? Because in my brain I was 13 when I came. No, 15. Yeah, so how was that decision made between you, the social, like you and dad as a family, and the social services?
We got the phone call to say that your mum was dead. They were having to think about what's next. And I said, well, she stays here for the minute until a decision's made, because you couldn't move with that news. We had a family, bit of a family confab, and everybody immediately said, she stays. We thought it'd be a couple of weeks. You know, and it went on a bit, and then there were court cases around the decision to take you into care, and we were made guardians of you.
Yeah.
But the decision had been always when we were fostering, it was the family. We need to talk about this. You have a right to say, and everyone was unanimous that you stay. I mean, I guess they couldn't imagine being in the situation you were in.
Yeah.
And you'd settled in well.
You had this little girl who'd been through a lot of trauma and then had more trauma added to that and then was living with you. Be honest, how hard was it looking after me throughout the whole process, but particularly in those early years? How hard was that?
I don't think we found it hard at all. Managing how you made contact with family, managing how you came back into the family afterwards was more difficult.
Mm.
There was a pull on you, I think, right all along to, you used to come back saying, oh, Nanny said blood's thicker than water. So there was all that pull on you. So the hard bit was helping you make that adjustment back and trying to take some of that stress off you of feeling like you'd got a choice, you know, because as the court decided, the court said that you needed a stable place and that we were prepared to offer that. And because we didn't have many babies after that, really, because we'd made that decision.
Yeah, because there wasn't really many. I remember maybe three or not many.
There were not many. Yeah. Not until Josh and Hannah came. Yeah. Because our time was with you to give you that. And because we had to have a big discussion with our youngest, how he felt about using his place in the family. Mm. He was no longer the baby.
Yeah. How did he take that?
He was fine with it, actually. He was always so fond of you.
Yeah, he was such a good big brother to me. He taught me how to tie my shoes and gave me 50p when I mastered it. I remember that.
Yeah,
he was a very good big brother to me. He even let me used to play with his friends in the alley at the back with my bike. Oh,
my goodness, that was a nightmare. Your risk-taking was the nightmare, not the care of you. I found you at 6.5, 7 on this little bike we'd managed to get for you, driving up ramps over hurdles with like the BMXs were doing.
I remember that going like that, and that was in the alley between Brian's
the back of the houses.
The back of Brian's house, I remember. Yeah,
you come in bleeding, and
I've actually got a scar on my knee from falling off that bike, and John carried me in like a little doll. Mum, she's hurt herself.
What did you let her do that for? Try and stop her.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was more of a hardship. You were quite accident prone. Mm-hmm. And I've since learned in all my own work that when someone's emotionally traumatized, they're more likely to have accidents.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's that that part of the brain that's losing some of its functionality.
Well, I mean, I certainly was like Mr. Bump, because the amount of times you had to go to hospital with me.
I know, I was getting worried I'd be on the abuse list.
I fell off the monkey bars twice. No, fell off the monkey bars once, went over the front handle of my bikes that go down
the top of that climbing frame.
In
the school playground. Yeah. No, in the school playground. They phoned to say you'd had a bit of an accident. And I got to the school gate and I was following this trail of blood, thinking, I hope that's not Emily. And she'd smashed your nose completely.
Yeah, I remember I had to go and have surgery.
You had to go and have it done, reshaped.
Yeah, yeah. And as a child, that's quite unusual because...
Yes, because bones don't... Yeah. Yeah. You must have come down with such a bump. You had two great big black eyes.
But I was most upset, not about my nose, but about the gorgeous dungarees that you'd made me. Do you remember those dungarees?
Yeah.
They had like splashes of paint on that looked like splashes of paint, but it was splashes of colour. And I was gutted because you said, I can't get the blood out of them. And I was literally heartbroken because I didn't care about my nose. I really wanted those dungarees because I used to get really attached to clothes.
Yes.
Which I don't know why. Maybe it's because I didn't really have... clothes. So I think when you started giving me nice clothes, I mean, my nan always made nice things for me, but my mum would never give them to me. So my nan would make me these beautiful pin-tuck dresses and just beautiful things my nan would make me, and she probably would sell them realistically for money, you know, support her habit with them. So I didn't really have nice things. So when it came to being with you and I had these little lovely little outfits and
Everything matched. I was so particular about how you looked because I felt that was important for you. Mm. You weren't going to have secondhand clothes.
Yeah. I remember I always looked really cute. You used to make me the sailor dresses with the collars. You spent a lot of time making sure that I, one, had a stable family life, but two, had the things that you knew I didn't have. I really appreciate that. Now, I mean, at the time, I probably wasn't very appreciative. I don't know.
Well, you don't expect children to be appreciative. Yeah. That they don't have to be thankful for being... Mm. You know, you do what you do in order to... what we did for you was to build your self-esteem, to give you self-value and self-worth and not have to be grateful.
Yeah, which makes sense. But in the same breath, you didn't have to. There was never a point... You didn't give birth to me, so there was no obligation on you, but you still did it anyway. And I think that's where I felt very lucky with you guys, because in all of the placements I'd had before, I was a strain or a drain or an added pressure. But when I came to you guys, I was treated with respect and made to feel like I was somebody important. And I'd never had that before.
And you were another member of the family. Yeah. You weren't an add-on. You were.
I agree with that. So I was very accident prone. I remember a really funny story. I said it last night, didn't I? So we had a policeman who lived at the bottom of the road. So there's many stories, but so one of them is when I came to you, I couldn't eat with a knife and fork at 6 years old, which is shocking, really. Mm. So I used to use my fingers to eat, you said. I don't think I could have been very clean either when I came to you, because I always remember my nan licking her thumb and going, look, you don't even wash her. And literally she'd wipe the dirt off my face and my mum would say, oh, she's fine. And my nan would take me upstairs and give me a bath and wash me and what have you. So I can imagine that when I came to you, I wasn't particularly clean or smelling very fresh or dressed very well. Then I couldn't eat with a knife and fork. I could only use my fingers. So I was kind of quite feral. I was a bit of a feral child, I suppose. And also... I would play in the road, you know, she'd let me out and, I looked after myself. So I'd open the front door and I'd go out onto the main road. And I remember one time there was a breeze block and I was playing with the breeze block because I had nothing else to play with, and I ended up dropping that breeze block on my foot. I actually remember that, and I could have only been about 4 years old. And I don't know how a four-year-old managed. I'm quite strong, and I always have been, but picked that up to do. I don't know what I thought I was doing with it, and I dropped it. Obviously, couldn't hold it because I wasn't strong enough, and that damaged my foot. I remember that. There were a lot of things about me that were not like a regular child that had been brought up in a stable family home. I didn't have the skills and capabilities that other children of my age had.
Social skills.
Yeah. But one of the stories was my mum obviously lived a certain lifestyle and had a term for the police. And you introduced me to a very lovely gentleman who lived at the bottom of our... So we lived in a cul-de-sac, and the house on the corner that was actually the main road, it wasn't on our road, so they had the main road address. They were a lovely husband and wife with two sons, and the father was a policeman, and he was friends with Dad, wasn't he? And he used to quite often come up and visit. And I remember looking out of the window one day and seeing him walking up the cul-de-sac and going... Oh, that pig's on his way to the house or something like that. Or the pig's here. And I remember, I feel embarrassed saying it now, but that was really normal for me, that it was acceptable in my household to have said, called a police officer that, because that in the 80s, if you were going to refer to the police as something derogatory, that's what you called them. Mm-hmm. People don't call them that anymore.
They don't.
But that's what I used to call them. And I remember you saying, Emily, you can't say that. You can't call him that. He's a policeman. But so that was just, these are just like little funny anecdotes, really, of, you know, me, how I was with you at that stage in my life. But I've always remembered a story that you told me about how I didn't really have a temper tantrum and that you thought there was actually something wrong with me.
Yeah, we talk about this so often at home. Yeah, you accepted everything so calmly that it was unreal, you know? You did, because you didn't cry a lot for your mum. We all felt like that something had happened to freeze you up.
Mm.
And you'd gone over to have to play with the little girl opposite, Jessica, do you remember?
Yeah.
And I was a bit late fetching you for tea. When I came to fetch you, Kit had said, oh, she's staying here for tea. And I said, no, she's coming home, because I felt boundaries were really important that time. And you stood on her doorstep and had the mightiest tantrum. And everybody was inside watching you going, yes, she's done it.
How old would I have been then?
You were 6. You were okay. Still. Yeah. Oh, you might, because your birthday's September, you might have been 7.
Yeah.
You might have been 7. But it was such a relief.
Yeah.
The other story, of course, was when you were with us, you came in the February.
Yeah.
When everybody started to have birthdays. So you were only 6 when you had your tantrum.
Okay.
Because John was the first birthday, and we always did the birthday table, do you remember, with everything on it. Oh, and you were in such a foul mood. Oh, goodness me. And we tried to explain, well, this will be for you when it's your birthday. Mm. But you had no concept of birthdays, did you?
No, because my family didn't celebrate birthdays because they were Jehovah's Witnesses. And I think my mum, although she wasn't a Jehovah's Witness, I wasn't that kind of thought to her.
Yeah.
So
we had John's to get through, and then we had Joe's to get through. Here we go. Be prepared for this. We'll have something small for her to open so that she's got a present. But when it came to your own birthday, you were so overwhelmed by it, you couldn't open anything.
Yeah.
And you were frozen for about half an hour. You were going to be late for school.
Aww.
Because suddenly this was all about you. Mm. And you just couldn't manage it. And in fact, I don't think you opened your presents till the evening.
Mm. It's funny, isn't it?
It is. So that whole getting used to, wanting to be part of, but struggling with the emotion that raised in you, or Yeah, mm. We've always remembered it. You know, yeah, when her birthday came, she really struggled.
I remember, actually, that you used to say, what cake do you want? And I loved hedgehogs.
Yeah.
I loved hedgehogs. And you made me a little hedgehog cake where you made a round cake and you cut it in half and then put it together. Yeah. And then put icing on it and then put matchmakers,
that's right, yeah.
On for the spikes. And I think I asked for that cake like how many years?
Oh, goodness me, for years we had hedgehog cake.
And you, I remember one year you saying, are you sure you don't want a different cake this year? And I was like, no. And you said, yeah, I'm sure you do. And you persuaded me to have a different cake because the hedgehog was, but also that this thing with repetitiveness and feeling safe was important.
Absolutely.
So I didn't really like change that much. Mm. So it was nice and comforting to me to have the same things happen over and over and over again. So, yeah. I mean, like I said, I don't really recall much. And I don't really even remember going to my mum's funeral. I know I went.
You did. We insisted that you went. Yeah.
I remember I went. And I can't remember who I was next to, whether it was my nan or...
Alan took you.
The social worker, yeah. So I remember him being there, but I don't remember whether I was allowed to stand next to my nan or not. Like, things like that, I can't remember, but I can just remember there was a lot of people there. It was a very big... It drew a very big crowd because my mum's family were quite well known. And obviously all the sisters were there, my uncles there, my nan, my granddad, and then all of the people were there to support them as well. But I don't remember. I don't remember how I felt. I don't remember anything really about it. So but that's the same for a lot of my life, even up till 8 years ago. A lot of things I forget. It's like my brain just purposely says,
you have to dissociate from it.
Yeah.
That's what trauma does.
Yeah. And you said something earlier which was quite poignant to me, and that was that my nan would always say blood's thicker than water, and that you always felt like I was being torn between the two. And I did feel like that. It was very hard for me. So basically what happened, for the people that don't know, so my nan went to court, she tried to get full custody, and they only granted her every other Saturday, I think it was. Yeah. It wasn't straight away either.
No, every third Saturday.
Every third Saturday. Because did Grandad have me as well?
Yeah, initially you alternated.
Yeah.
Fortnightly, and then it changed, and it was every third Saturday.
To my nan. I remember that feeling of her saying, your mum would want you with me, blood's thicker than water. And me feeling like, well, I love my nan. You know, I love her. She's my nan. Of course I loved her. She was, when I was with my mum, she was my safe space. Mm. But also, hold on a minute, I've got a family here who are really safe and I feel safe with them. So for those years that I was with you, there was this constant battle with my nan and you. I felt like, I mean, from how I feel looking back on it, she was always trying to get custody of me.
Always.
She was always trying to discredit you and dad and the family. Do you know, because that's the only thing that I really vividly remember, was because Nan didn't want me to carry on going to a church school.
And then she promised the judge you would stay there. Because that was one of our things. We weren't going to fight for you. Mm. But we wanted your stability to be that you stayed at the school. They predicted high GCSE grades. Mm. And we knew she wasn't telling the truth.
No. And then, and that didn't do very well for my life either, to be honest with you. But while I was with you and you were going through all of these struggles and tugs with my nan, that surely had some kind of negative impact on you, because it could not have been easy to go through that.
It wasn't easy to stand in a witness box and be called a prostitute, you know, and it wasn't easy to be accused of being non-compliant with access and things, because we were totally compliant. And the impact, it had a huge impact on Dad. Mm. He never... it took him years and years and years to get over you going.
Mm.
And still now, it comes back to the surface sometimes. Mm. For me, it was the tug of war of wanting desperately to say you can't have her, she's got to stay, and not putting you under that strain of feeling like you were being pulled in both directions.
Yeah, I mean, I remember an incident occurred, and it was just not long before the court case, the final court case, and you were at work. You were working at the hospice, I think, or you were working at a nursing.
I think I'd gone to a fostering meeting.
Okay. And Dad was at home with me and Josh and Hannah, and I couldn't cope, and I decided that at 13 my life was over and that I should end my life. And I remember going into the bathroom cabinet and just getting as many tablets as I don't know what even they were.
Paracetamol.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that would kill me, you know, taking that many paracetamols. And I don't remember how it came about that Dad found me, or maybe I told him.
You came down and told him.
Yeah, because I probably had second thoughts.
Yeah, of course you did.
And I ended up having to go to hospital and have my stomach pumped. And then I had to have the psych team come in. But at that age, 13, to feel that under pressure, that's your decision, that you felt like I felt for a moment, whether that was a 5 or 10 minute moment, however long it was, that I didn't really want to be going through that anymore, and it was probably a better option to not be around so that I could escape that feeling. It's really hard for me to think about that because I have children of my own. And if my children, we had conversations earlier, but if my children were feeling like that, and you know, because they've just come down and told you, I mean, probably the worst that could have happened is I'd have had a liver or kidney failure and been not very well for the rest of my life. But still, I didn't know. I thought that taking those tablets was going to kill me, and that was it. I was going to be off the face of the earth. And then I told Dad, and he was like, "You silly girl, I'm here by myself. What am I going to do with Josh and Hannah?" And I remember him panicking and having to get a neighbour. That in itself must have been really hard for you guys to deal with.
For me to come home and find what you'd done, and I hadn't been there because I'd been at a stupid meeting. I was beside myself, really. I mean, we both felt that it was intolerable for you. You know, to be put in that position, and you should never have been put in that position.
Yeah, I mean, I feel quite emotional about it. I'm quite good at swallowing back my tears, but I remember turmoil, it feels like, you know, because you are so pulled between two groups of people that you love. And you know that maybe one group of people isn't very good for you, but you love them regardless because they're your flesh and blood. And then you know that this group of people that have taken you in under their wing and treated you respectfully and loved you and brought you in as a member of the family, I almost felt like I shouldn't love you. Does that make sense?
That's exactly what we felt was happening. That you felt guilty for being settled.
Yeah, I think that was very hard for me. You're not even coping with your own
thoughts. You shouldn't have been given permission, any idea that you had to make the choice. Yeah. You shouldn't. Yeah. It was wrong, and the new social worker that came in was totally out of order, even suggesting it.
So this social worker that came in, was she the lady that smelled like ginger? I remember her. So she had a perfume and it smelled like ginger. It's funny because every now and then I get a whiff of that perfume. It's really weird.
Yeah.
But I do remember her. And for my nan, she was the best thing to ever have happened. And then for you, she was the worst thing to ever have happened, because previous social workers, they were still supportive of the right situation, whereas she came in and she was like, hold on, this little girl should really be with her family. And, you know, she's got a loving, supporting family. And then... So my nan basically stopped drinking to get custody of me, didn't she? And that was kind of how that came about, because she had to prove that she wasn't drinking, from what I can remember, so that she could get custody of me, which would be right. You know, you can't be an alcoholic and have an impressionable teen come and live with you. And it went to court and they asked me. And I remember, and I'm going to apologise to you for this, because... They were trying to ask me for reasons why I shouldn't be living with you. The only thing that I could think of negative to say, and we can, maybe you can laugh about it, but I actually carry a lot of guilt about this. And every time I see this biscuit, I think of this situation. I said to them, I don't want to live there anymore because this is, I had to say why I didn't want to. I don't want to live there anymore because when we go food shopping, mum eats all the penguins. And that was the only reason that I had to come up with. Now, I can't have, I don't like having penguins in my house.
And I never ate penguins. I don't like the darn things.
But that was the reason I gave them. And what kind of ignoramus would take a child away from a home who says something like that? I mean, it's not a valid reason. And two, obviously, I was trying to find something when there wasn't anything. So common sense prevails that there's no reason for anyone to take a child away. But I actually vividly remember that them asking, pressing me, why don't you want to live there? Pressing. And that was the only thing I could come up with. So I apologise for saying that.
You were in an impossible situation.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it wasn't easy. When I left, I used to sneak up to see you, didn't I? I came up a couple of times to see you. And you actually said, you can't keep doing this. You're going to get us into trouble. I remember you saying, do you remember?
Mm.
So you were in the big house and we'd been there for a while. It wasn't a new move.
Yeah.
And it wasn't far from my school. It was literally a stone's throw from the school I was at. So I could come and visit you and get home and still be home on time without anybody knowing that I'd come to visit you. But you told me, you know, unless it's organised, you can't. You're going to get me into trouble. I saw that as rejection. I found that really hard to deal with. Obviously now, as an adult, looking back on it, I completely understand, but my brain couldn't compute, you know, was something that I wasn't allowed to do and that it would get you into trouble. And I took it quite negatively, actually.
And I also think, which you probably wouldn't have heard me say, but I did also was worried about you getting into trouble.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I know how much your nan didn't like us.
Yeah. And you probably did say that, but my memory is that. But like we said earlier, everybody has their own version of reality of events, don't they? And then I moved in with my nan. So she got custody of me. So I'm living there. Obviously, we've talked about that. And it rang warning bells. Even at that age, it was like, is that right? I don't think so. But she was my nan and I loved her. And I thought, right, okay, she's just having a little blip. She's just in a mood, you know. And then it just progressively got worse because what happened was her not drinking only lasted as long as getting custody of me. And so her crutch of drinking again came back. But with her crutch of drinking came physical violence. Aggressive. Yeah. And I love, look, don't get me wrong, I love my nan and I completely understand as an adult what her emotional state was. But as a teenager who has left a home that's safe and secure to be with your nan because she's telling you, look, we'll have a great life together, things are going to be wonderful, to go from your family home where I had cooked meals every day, even if it was potato and leek soup, which I hated. You had to force down my neck sometimes. But even if it was to go to my nan who was giving me a box of Iceland burgers and I was allowed one of them with two slices of bread and a fried egg, you know, that was really hard because we know how much I love food, which is something else we spoke about earlier. I'll just briefly touch on it, that I didn't have food at my mum's. I was very a neglected child, so I didn't eat there. And I would only eat if my Uncle Alan, who was my auntie's ex-boyfriend, went to the wholesalers and bought tins of smash and frozen cod in sauce. And he taught me at a very, very young age how to make those things without me burning myself or hurting myself so that I did have sustenance because otherwise I just wouldn't eat. My mum wouldn't feed me, you know. So food was a really big thing for me, even is now.
Mm.
I do struggle sometimes. I find myself struggling sometimes to share food with people because I'm like that. Even though I might be sat like that, my brain is thinking protect your food. So, and it's inbred in me now. So I went from your house with you guys, eating lovely home-cooked meals. You'd make spaghetti bolognese from scratch, lasagna from scratch, cottage pie, roast dinners, all sorts of wonderful foods that you used to cook for us. And Dad used to do the dishes.
Yes.
Literally, my nan probably cooking on a Sunday. And it's funny because you said something yesterday. We went out for an Indian. And I didn't say it at the time because I was saving it for now. But you said, oh, not a korma, not anything creamy. I don't like a korma. And I hate korma. And the reason being is because that was my nan's favourite dish to cook. So on a Sunday, she was a very talented cook. My nan was, we can both say that. She was a very good cook. She used to make a korma and it would be very traditional flavours. And she'd make it with dal and rice and we'd have some breads with it, you know, naan or chapati or something. And she would make it all from scratch herself. But that food literally would last all week. And when it ran out, I'd then have to have burger, bread, an egg. And if you've ever tried to eat a greasy burger with a fried egg in a very thin, you know, thin bread, it literally just dissolves in your fingers. It's just disgusting. She didn't have much money. Mm. She did a couple of hours of cleaning a week that I used to help her go and do. She struggled, you know, to pay the bills, but she was also drinking and a lot of her money was going on alcohol. Drink. I was, however, very well dressed. I did travel a lot when I lived with her. I went to America countless times. I went to Portugal. You know, I had experiences that I didn't have before. So there were bonuses of being with her. I kind of felt like I'd reverted back to the times before you. And that for me was really hard. I had no privacy. She was paranoid that I would become an addict like my mum. And so literally watched me like a hawk. And there was no locks on the bathroom doors. And we shared a bed because the flat was so small where we lived. And I found that very, very hard. I wanted to study and I'd be sat studying and she'd be telling me, what are you doing? You need to be doing the housework. And I'd have to clean the house from top to bottom and do all the dishes and cook her food as well. Study was not important to her at that time.
Never was.
Yeah. Which is strange because one thing I do remember having a conversation with my nan about was how that she wanted me to do well in school because she actually got into an art college and her mum stopped her going because she was a girl and there was a reason behind that. And she said to me, I just want you to do well at school so that you can go to college and get some qualifications. So I knew it was something she wanted, but when she was drinking, her whole outlook on life was completely different. And she was very physically aggressive. So I was always living in fear of what's going to happen next and always anxious. And it just wasn't nice. It was just like being back with my mum. Although it wasn't as bad because she was a much safer environment, much, much safer environment. It still wasn't very nice. Mm-hmm. And very hard for me as a teenager to deal with. And so it just came to the point where I just said, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm leaving. And I packed my stuff. And she was out, actually, and she came back. I don't know how she knew to come back, but she came back. I don't know if one of the neighbours had run, because mobile phones were around then. And I don't know if one of the neighbours had called her and said, Emily's chucking black bags out of the front window, it looks like she's leaving. And I had actually someone who was a friend of my mum's from school, and I'm not going to mention his name because he probably could still get into trouble if he's doing the same job, but he was working at the college I was at. And I said to him, you were a friend of my mum's. He said, yeah. I said, I need your help. He said, I can't help you, I'll lose my job. And I said, I'm just give me a lift. Just take me to my nan's, let me get my stuff, don't come in. Let me get my stuff and just take me somewhere. And he was like, I shouldn't do it, but I'm going to do it. It's the right thing to do. So I literally went to the house, just chucked as much of my clothes in black bin bags, like two or three black bin bags, chucked them out the front window of that place and I left. And then as she saw me chucking, she must have seen me chucking bags out or something. She came in and she was like, "Don't go, don't go. Please don't go." And I said, "I can't do this anymore. I'm leaving." I just said to her, "No." And I pushed her out of the way, very gently, just pushed her out of the way. And I said, "I'm going." And that was it. And I was gone. And I actually didn't go back for 3 years. I think, I can't remember what happened. I thought, you know what, I'll go and see her. So I went and saw her. And we were okay on speaking terms and everything. And she said, "Come back." And I said, "No, I'm not going back." And I got a flat not far from her. And it just wasn't right. The environment, she'd come and knock on my door whenever she wanted to. She'd turn up, you know, all times. I actually said to the landlord, I said, "I can't stay. I've got someone who can take the flat on. Can I leave?" And they were like, "Yeah, it's fine." And then I left. And then from that day, I didn't see her for another 10 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't see her for 10 years. And then I held a lot of resentment towards my nan. I was very angry with her for the things that I'd felt and that I'd been put through with you. And then when I lived with her, I think I had my middle child. And she was about 14, 15 months old, maybe a bit older than that, not much older than that though. And I thought, you know what? She's a great grandma. They need to meet her. And who knows how long she's going to have left, and let them at least just meet her. And that was really sad for me, because when I got to see her after all those years, the drinking was so bad. It was even worse than before. And she was malnourished. She was in and out of hospital for malnutrition because all she was doing was drinking alcohol. And she was just depressed and lonely. And she was neglected by her children that were in the same town as her. And she, you know, she just needed company. At that point, she wasn't aggressive. She was just drunk, just, you know, babbling drunk, really. And I did take the children there a couple of times, but one time she got up and she said, "I've got to go for a wee." And she tripped over herself and she did a wee on the floor. And I got her up, cleaned her up, and I said to myself, "I'm never doing this again. And my children can't see it."
Absolutely.
And that was it. I spent time with her, but my children didn't. So she'd ring me up and she'd say, "Oh, I've got no food shopping." And I'm living in London. So I'd drive all the way down there, take her food shopping. "Oh, my washing machine's broken. Can you help me?" Take her to Argos to buy a new washing machine. You know, so she was quite reliant on me emotionally. I think it was an emotional crutch rather than actual needs in me. She just wanted to see me. She was more than capable of going and doing those things herself, but she wanted me to go down there. So I'd take the journey down there and spend time with her if I could, but I didn't take my children down after that day. And then she passed away. And I took them to the funeral because I thought it was important. Yeah. To say their goodbyes. And my middle one actually still remembers that. And she could have only been three. She wasn't any older than three or four. Gosh. And she actually still remembers. And she says, "Oh, I remember when we went to the graveyard and we buried Nanny." The whole thing with her was quite turbulent and not an easy relationship. It was hard. But also, I think that pulling backwards and forwards made me feel like I never really fitted in anywhere. So I didn't feel, although you guys treated me like family, I didn't feel like I fit in like family.
You weren't allowed, were you?
Yeah. There was always something stopping me. And then with her, I didn't feel like I fit in with her because my mentality was completely different because I'd spent so much time with you guys. And then I feel like that kind of carried on throughout my life as well. So I would have groups of friends, but I would have very different groups of friends. I'd have friends that were my own age, and then I'd have friends that were a lot older. But I never felt like I ever fit in anywhere. So I was a bit of a drifter. I always used to refer to myself as a loner. I'd say, "Oh, I'm just a loner." That was because I was quite happy to be a loner. So when I had children of my own, my sole focus was my children and being everything my mum wasn't, providing for them all the things that I didn't have provided for me. By her, not by you. And one thing that I was always really anal about, and I use the word anal, but I was really anal about, was getting them to school on time and picking them up on time. And even to this day, when my childminder calls me to tell me that the bus or train is delayed for her to pick up Moo, I go into panic. Mm. And I know that that's because that inner...
Yeah, you weren't there.
Yeah.
They weren't there for you.
Yeah. And so I know what that feels like as a child of that age, to be to feel like someone's forgotten you.
To be forgotten.
Yeah.
To be insignificant.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing that I really am really strict about with nannies for Moo is they have to make sure that they pick her up on time. And one thing I'm strict about is getting her to school on time. And that routine, and that was something my friends always used to joke. I never had a routine, obviously, with my mum. There was no routine. I'd do what I want when I wanted. With you guys, I had a strict routine. We'd get up at a certain time. Mm. We'd have lunch at a certain time, dinner at a certain time, bed at a certain time. And that is something I carried through with my parenting, with my children, because it's so important for children to have routine.
Absolutely.
So my friends would say, oh, you're like a sergeant major. But it wasn't. I was just routined. And you know what? All three of my babies slept. My eldest from 8 weeks, my middle from 10, and my youngest from 12, all through the night from 7 till 7. And it's because I had routine in place.
Structure.
And stability.
We can't survive without structure.
Yeah.
And that's what your nan lost. She lost structure in her life.
Yeah.
So if you don't know what's next and what's coming next, that's scary.
It was scary being with her. And it was probably scary for her as well. Because not long after my mum passed away, it wasn't that long after that my uncle then passed away. Maybe 6 or 7 years, not much long after. And that was her only son. Mm. So she had a lot of loss, didn't she? And I don't blame her at all. Mm. You know, and I think that when you become an adult that's mature to recognise that nobody's perfect, that you can forgive and you can forget and put it beyond you.
Yeah. I think the sadness for your nan at where we stood was she couldn't work with us.
Mm.
She couldn't integrate being the nan, and we would have, you know, the court set the contact times, but we'd have been much more flexible.
Yeah.
But she wasn't prepared to negotiate with us. Mm. And that, I felt that was really sad, because you missed out then. Mm. And she missed out.
Yeah, that is sad, because she wasn't capable, and it was more of Emily's a possession than
absolutely
anything else. And
because when the suggestion that you go back, we said, why don't we try, first of all, Emily having every weekend with Nan so that she has more contact time. Mm. That wasn't enough. Mm. And it's sad. And in fact, you being there wasn't enough, because it was that she was grieving for.
Yeah, and you can't replace.
You can't fill the hole.
With a grandchild.
No, you can't.
You can't.
So that was the sadness. Mm. We never felt bitter. We felt devastated and sad. Mm. But yeah. You look on things as an adult differently, don't you?
Yeah. I spent the majority of my adult life resenting my mum, my nan, my dad. I met my dad when I was 19, and I didn't like him. He was racist. I didn't get on with him really. And whenever I would ask him a question as to why he didn't come and take me as my father when she died, he'd say, oh, well, I knew where you were. I knew what you were doing. But that wasn't answer enough. That's a shitty answer.
Mm. Again, you're insignificant.
Yeah, I didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And yet another person who's supposed to love me put me second, third, fourth, fifth or sixth in their life.
Mm.
When I met my dad, we didn't really get on very well, is the honest truth. But the reason I say that is because when he got sick, because he had mental degeneration, so he had dementia, up until that point, I'd probably seen him 5 times in my life. And I couldn't build a relationship with him. But when he got sick, and he didn't really know who I was, I actually spent more time with him. which is really odd. And I mean, I feel like it's odd because I didn't owe him anything, but he was in a care home and I used to drive down there and I would spend an hour with him and drive back. And I do that quite regularly. I'd take him clothes or laundry, you know, stuff to wash himself, or cigarettes when he was still asking for cigarettes. But I did all those things because I'd forgiven him. It took a lot for me to get to that stage in life because I literally was a very angry woman for a very long time. I couldn't spend time with you guys because I felt guilty. I couldn't spend time with my family because I didn't feel like I fit in. I couldn't integrate myself with my dad's family, even though some of them wanted to. I just couldn't do it. I didn't have the capabilities. But when I had my own children, I think all that changed because then that family unit is your own and you look at things very differently. So, like I said, I got in touch with my nan again and spent time with her. And then she passed away. And then, so that burden, it was a burden, had gone, but also was quite sad, you know, because my mum's gone, my gran's gone, my granddad's gone, I'm alone again. But then I kind of said to myself, life has thrown at you what it's thrown at you, but look how resilient I am. Look how strong I am. And actually, had I have not gone through those things, would I be as understanding of other people and their needs and their emotions? Yes. Maybe I wouldn't be. Maybe I would have been a really not understanding person and,
uncaring.
Uncaring, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I do, and the thing is, I do care about people.
Yeah.
And I don't have time for people as much as I'd like to, but I do try to let people know that they mean something to me. And I think that maybe if I'd have had an easy life, I wouldn't be the person I am today. So everything that I went through taught me something very valuable and made me who I am today. And that's important.
Yeah. You said some really significant things, really. You said about forgiveness.
Mm.
And I think you've forgiven yourself as well. There's no guilt, there's no condemnation from where we stand. But I think you have forgiven yourself for making decisions or whatever.
Mm.
But someone very wisely said, and I've always remembered it, unless we wipe a tear from our own eyes, we can't help someone wipe tears from theirs.
Mm.
And that's so true.
Mm.
What we learn in life helps us be a better person. Mm.
And I literally wouldn't be here today if it weren't for you and Dad and John and Joe and Sam and Josh and Hannah. And I am eternally grateful because whenever anybody asks me where I got my impeccable manners from, I always tell them it's from you. And you did teach me a lot of very valuable life lessons and also how to be loved and to show love.
Mm.
So for that, I am eternally grateful to you, and you and Dad do mean a lot to me. I know I don't spend as much time with you as I should, but
busy lives, and I just want to say it was our pleasure. We found a lot of joy when you joined our family. Didn't bring us sorrow. It brought sorrow at the end, but we understood that it was something. We didn't hold any grudges.
Yeah.
So every time you made contact, was another joy.
And that actually goes to show what wonderful people you and Dad are.
No,
it does, because not everybody would go through that turmoil and still open their doors to someone. And you always have. Your door's never been closed to me. And you could have easily shut off and said, right, I've got to stop that part because I don't want to be hurt again. And you didn't. And I am very grateful to that for you. I'm very grateful to you for that. So thank you. And I hope you give Dad a big cuddle and a kiss for me. And
I will.
And all those jams and chocolates.
Yes, that you bought him. He's going to put on another half stone.
No. Just give him little portions each day. Would be fine.
No.
But thank you.
And thank you.
And I, more than anything, I really want to thank you for coming down and doing this because, you know, you've got your own responsibilities and it's quite a long way for you to come. So I am really grateful and I've really enjoyed it. It's been nice. Just you, actually. It's been nice to just have you around.
It's it's been great. It's been nice to play together.
Yeah, we've had fun. Thank you so much for watching Emily Abraham Presents the Love Luxury Podcast, and for my amazing guest, my mum, Elaine, for coming all the way down to visit us. Don't forget that if you've got any comments or any subjects that you'd like us to cover, put them in the comments below. Thank you so much.